I tell you one thing that it's been my experience that most writers who are published can't write and don't pay attention to the English sentence. That's the saddest thing of all.
I think that print journalism is among the worst writing.
What kind of journalism?
Print journalism.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I feel as a novelist. People don't think out the English sentence. They tend to put down what they. I don't know what they do. They don't think out the problems of. A lucidity.
Well, in the Tree of Life, you obviously did a great deal of thought about the sentence and never used the sentence in the way that, say, McKinley Cantor used the sentence in Spirit Lake, which is also about the frontier, although in Iowa, quite a few years distant. And the reason I cited Spirit Lake is that there are so many graphic incidents of frontier life that we don't think about. Brutality, horror. The reason I mention Spirit Lake is not because it is like the Tree of Life. It's not. It's an entirely different approach, and yet it shows many of the same incidents of brutality. For example, in Spirit Lake there is an incident where a group of Indians stage a homosexual rape after attacking settlers in Iowa. In the Tree of Life, there's no homosexual rape, as I recall, but there are so many incidents of brutality. The reason I mentioned it was that here were incidents of violence based on frontier incidents. The approach that McKinley Cantor had in the writing was so much different from yours, because in the Tree of Life, of course, you use what amounts to a journal, and in which the hero is a Keen. Yeah, I get confused.
It's Keen because it's compounded of two things, Thomas from the Doubting Thomas, and Keen because he's the one who perceives. I mean, he's the man who sees and is keen. I mean, he's the one who's recording. He's the artist, the American artist. And so it is Keen. It's a name meaning to give him symbolic resonance.
Well, Keene, of course, keeps a journal over this period of a year, approximately 1811, isn't that correct?
Right. It begins in 1811 and ends in October 1812. It begins the 1st of July, 1811, and ends the evening of October 11th, 1812.
McKinley Cantor tells us of the horror of life on the frontier, of what was then the frontier stretched further west.
Right.
And he tells us of that, but Thomas Keene doesn't have to tell us. He, in a very matter-of-fact way, lists the things that have happened to him, and the horror builds in the reader's imagination. And I thought this was a marvelous achievement, that you could create this feeling and not have to say how bad things were, but just to illustrate a daily chronicle of life, and then go from the thing. One of the things that made the horror of it stand out even more. Thomas Keene in his journal would describe an incident, and then in the next line he would describe what he made for dinner, and then the sale of another bottle of 80 proof whiskey. And I thought this was something very unusual and very unique. So let's go back a little ways. And I want to ask you some questions about yourself.
Please.
Maybe I ought to do that before we get into the origins of the Tree of Life.
Sure.
You were born here in New York.
I was born in New York. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, in March of 1933. Two parents, one of whom was born in the United States, and my father was an immigrant here from Warsaw, from Poland, came here at the age of seven. I was educated in New York at the Ethical Culture and Fieldston School, and then I went for 4 years to Swarthmore College, where I graduated in 1955.
It's a Quaker school.
It's a Quaker school, yes. Yeah, a small Quaker school, very fine school, an extraordinary school. Certainly wasn't those years, I imagine it remains, in Pennsylvania. And I always knew I was an artist. I mean, I wanted very much to be a writer. And also I drew. I drew really before I wrote as a kid. I was very interested in drawing. But I became more interested, I think, as I grew older. The first recollection I have of writing something was at the age of 10. I remember I wrote a poem. I still remember a fragment of it. But I became...
How did that go?
It was about spring. And it's interesting because at that age, I remember vividly, I was 10 or 11, and it contains the lines... Wait a minute. Pan is dancing forth and back, and bees are carrying little sacks of honey and of nectar too. There's already a kind of melodic line there. And also, what interests me in retrospect is that it already mentions the great god Pan, that already as a kid I was aware of mythology in a way that very many artists become aware. It was a conduit to a kind of wider imagination and to truth about the human being. I couldn't have expressed it obviously then, I just know I loved the stories.
Did your immigrant parents encourage you?
Yes, immensely. I think both, because they had been, my father certainly had been denied a higher education. I think he had to quit school when he was 12. He had to go out and support his family. And my mother had gone through a high school and wanted to go to law school, but felt guilty about it. Her father was a very poor and impoverished tailor. And she wanted to help support the family, and so she did not. She, in point of fact, met and married my father. But there were people who came, although they were people who did not come in their immediate past, certainly my mother did not, from any intellectual tradition. They're people who had a deep respect for an intellectual tradition and for the idea of learning. And
what did your father do?
My father was now, he's now retired, he was a manufacturer of dresses. He was in the shmata business in New York, which is a characteristic, Jewish occupation.
He must have been successful.
Yeah, he was a man who was a successful businessman, and he was determined that I should get an education. It was something which he had always felt badly about. They lived in dire conditions in the Lower East Side, about which I wrote my last book, in point of fact, a novel which concerns Jewish immigrant life on the Lower East Side, and also mythology. It's also a recapitulation of the story of Jacob and Esau.
Was work or life for you being the son of Polish immigrants?
Well, it was interesting insofar as I found that my contemporaries were, of course, extraordinary. A bunch of kids, this was the 50s, we didn't know it then, but it was obviously America at the very high point, certainly economically. The world seemed to us, America owned the world. The kids were terrific. There was, I'm sorry to say, an incident, several incidents of anti-Semitism among the, not the faculty so much as the administration in those years, which was very sad.
Involving yourself?
Yeah.
Well,
I was interested at that point, in going to Israel. I had the feeling that I wanted to... I was looking for a metaphor about which to write. I was looking for a scene to dramatize. It was half inchoate. Make a long story short, I had asked a man who was then dean, he's now gone, of the school, and he blew up at me and became furious. Asked me, was I a Jew? And I said, yes. And then he became furious at the idea that... we Jews had somehow permeated the school, and why did we... And I was absolutely appalled, and for a horrifying moment, I thought I'd tell him where to get off, and then I held my breath, and I said to him, I was immensely disappointed, and I said to him that how deeply sorry I was that this had happened, and how hypocritical he was, because he was a man who was, after all, the dean of a very fine intellectual American institution, who purported to be interested in... the life of the mind, and who really wasn't. And I said that I was proud that the Arabs had called the Jews the people of the book, and I was proud of that definition, and I believed in the life of the mind, and I was deeply hurt. He was a vicious man, and I told, brokenhearted, I told a member of the faculty, who was a dear friend of mine, also gone, not a Jew, about this, and he said yes, he was sorry to say that there was, in certain quarters, a kind of... it was a vicious kind of anti-intellectualism and anti-Semitism going on. There was a fight always going on. And that's, of course, isn't it the truth? Or ain't it the truth? It's the nature of life.
It's 30 years ago.
It's 30 years ago. There was, at that point in the life of American colleges, there was a very definite numerous clauses. There was only a percentage of Jews were allowed in. I remember vividly, sophomore year, a Jewish girl. Did not think of myself in these terms because I was totally accepted by the kids. There was never any question. I was not aware of any. My friends were indiscriminate. Everybody. It never occurred to me. But a Jewish girl once approached me and she said, did I realize that there was a 9% lid on the number of Jews at Swarthmore? And I was horrified. It never occurred to me that this was... Things, of course, have changed. But it was, I think, a realization of this. In many ways, it was a very important aspect of my education because it enabled me to begin to articulate to myself a double vision about life. And when I went eventually to Israel, where I had my first job writing a movie, a terrible movie. I got a job when I was 24 years old, but it was an immensely important time in my life. I realized very quickly that as an artist, certainly, and as a Jew, as a human being, I was both outside and inside of the culture. And this is inevitable, I think, for the development of an artist. I think whatever it is that makes you, I mean, artists are traditionally both. It is the dual vision, I think, that helps make you into an artist. I'm certainly not the first nor the last artist who has experienced this in one way or another. But it sharpened my sense of being an observer in a curious way and looking for a tradition, which finds, I think, its consummation in its American aspect in this book. My first four books were very much, all of them, concerned with Jewish identity in the 20th century and the metaphysic of being a Jew who was struggling with the Jewish idea of God and the meaning of Jewishness, the feeling of the problem of Jewish chosenness, the problem of the Holocaust, which defined my era, and Hitlerism, which absolutely defined what I was. I mean, I grew up deeply aware of this. But I'd always been also very aware of myself as having inculcated American Protestant identity. I mean, I was always fascinated. I knew as much, indeed, I came from a really non-religious background. My father is a religious person, but I was bar mitzvahed, but this was not an important aspect of my life. So I found that I was as conversant, or I educated myself as much in Christianity as I did in my own heritage. And I began realizing this was a wonderful thing, because I am also an American. After all, the American language is my religion and my nationality. I mean, it's what Camus said of French. It is the medium by which I express myself and how I see and live. And I always wanted very much to attach myself to the mainstream of the American literary tradition, because after all, my fathers were Herman Melville and Mark Twain and Ernest Hemingway and T.S. Eliot and Nathaniel Hawthorne, and these are all the figures, these are the people who, Edgar Allan Poe, whom I read as a kid, whom I identified with.
Well, with the Tree of Life, you certainly have identified yourself with the American literary tradition. Up until the Tree of Life, you might have been considered a Jewish writer.
Yes, I think so.
Now I think you could be considered a writer,
yes,
who is Jewish.
Yeah, I think
if you consider yourself,
yeah,
Jewish.
I think that's really what has happened. And I feel very deeply that in our most blessed of all societies, it seems to me that we were also fortunate to be Americans. I mean, I grew up in an era where it was not only a good thing, but it was the normal thing to be a great American patriot. We all realized growing up in my time, and we still realize that I think my generation is marked by the realization that America is the salvation of the world, like it or not. It is the great human experiment. It is the place where, as I can write, from the very beginning, there was the dichotomy between the ideal of equality and the reality of the racial conflict. But this is the struggle for the American soul. But I, for one, feel immensely grateful and lucky that I was born here. I took a cab down here, and I spoke to the cab driver. I always do. I love to talk to cab drivers in New York. And he was Romanian. And I asked him about coming here and his experience, and his excitement at being an American citizen was thrilling to me. I mean, because it was the excitement that I still feel. It is a rare privilege, and it is a great, also it's a terrific literary tradition. I mean, my goodness, within a few short years of our founding as a republic, that we gave the world such voices in our vernacular as Mark Twain, or such the only writer that I know in human history that has taken on Shakespeare and the Bible, the King James, Herman Melville. This is within a few years. The man who most influenced the European Romantic tradition, Edgar Allan Poe. What a remarkable civilization. Rich.
And we're still doing that.
Of course we are.
Because we have the kind of society that permits the freedom of communication and interchange of ideas.
Of course. I mean, it is, seems to me, one of the things that I am looking forward to as an American writer is when there, and it will come, I know it will come, there will be an efflorescence of black English writing in America that will make us all just gasp in astonishment. There is a song in black English which is magnificent, and it waits, and there will come a genius. I know it. I mean, sooner or later, there will be somebody. There are now great, you know, wonderful figures of young black writers who are using this in a daring and a wonderful way. But think of all the songs that exist in our language.
I'm skeptical about that, Hugh. I guess I have. It's because I take a more traditionalist view toward our language, and the reason that there is a black English is because it is expressed by people who have not had the cultural or educational background to follow the forms of our language. And so they take shortcuts and they develop language because it's easier to do it than to speak in the mainstream or write in the mainstream.
Well, I think that language, the development of language at any time, is always a combination of the high language, the language of the educated elite, and the language of the gutter, the language of the streets. And I think that the educated elite, at its peril, certainly the artists who are educated, at their peril, cut themselves off from the immense efflorescence that is always coming from below. And I don't know how much is going to last, but I do know that songs are always being sung from below. I watch, for example, I don't know Hebrew very well, but I know it enough to realize that the great struggle in Israel in the last, since 48, has been the search for vernacular language, which is coming out of the army now, and coming out of the interchange with Arabs, and coming in, that it is in the brains of human beings, in their daily commerce and transactions, that a living language is formed. And there is also concurrently always a high literary tradition, and it is the interchange of these two that I play with in this book. I hope not self-conscious, but I certainly was self-aware. I'm constantly playing off the American vernacular with the magnificent American vernacular with the magnificent tradition of, for example, the King James, the wonderful, in a sense, particularly in one of my favorite characters, the Reverend Cooper, his sermons, in which juxtaposed side by side are both, the beautiful stream of language that comes out of the King James, and his ungrammatical American English, which is being formed. One of the things that Keane talks about, which is something that I was interested in showing the beginnings of the American tongue, is he comments upon the formation of the word dumb. Which seems to come, as far as we know, from the German, the Pennsylvania Dutch, from Dummkopf. But the use of it as stupid is an American, apparently. And he picks this up because I was trying to show that the language is always changing. The infusion, as Keane comments in this book, of Indian words into the language. He comments on it. Think of all the words that come from the Algonquian tongue. Moccasin, tomahawk. And language to me, the American language, because it is mine, and I love it. I think our language is. I must say, the French. I know every nation, I suppose, believes in its own cultural superiority in terms of language. I think we have the greatest language in the world. I think that English and American English, in particular, we have 450,000 words. I mean, twice as much as any other. The richness. Developing from both the Norman French and the Anglo-Saxon. I mean, there you have the exact what I'm trying to say. You have the low language and you have the high language, both flowing together into a mighty, magnificent river. But I've always conceived of language as something evolving all the time, growing all the time. It is alive because our brains are alive and because we change, and therefore the instrument by which we think, and which determines our way of thinking, language itself, is always growing and changing. It seems to me that the artist must always be alert to the living nature of a tongue and the spoken virtues of that language. And you must always, I am a classicist, and I am fixed quite firmly within a tradition. I mentioned these artists before. They are my mentors. However, I like to keep my ears open and to what sounds are coming all around me. My melody is already established, but it was established when I was a kid, from what I read and what I heard. But I'm aware that there's always growth and development. And I think that it is incumbent upon any artist at any time, and particularly the American artist now, as always, to be alert to the fact that his language is not fixed, but is always changing and growing. It is a wonderful, wonderful medium of expression. And
let's get back on track.
Right.
Swarthmore. You
Please.
Finished Swarthmore. What did you do?
Well, I finished Swarthmore, and I came home. For a year, I was very interested in writing plays. And I wrote a play at college, which was performed, and I knew instantaneously that I had a gift for dialogue. I could tell the way it sounded. I knew that I had the melody. I knew the way people I could replicate or create the illusion of people speaking. And I came and I went for a year to Columbia, the School of Dramatic Arts, where I took studies in the theater. And I thought perhaps I wanted to go into the theater, but I realized that I wasn't writing. I was studying academically in a way that was cutting me off from, I had to learn how to write. And then I got a job in the New York Times running copy. And at the point at which I was approached to be to be upgraded, I mean, given a promotion. And I came home and I said to my parents, look, this is the first kind of fork in my road. I know that I could have a career at the Times. I saw it. I mean, I have a passionate interest in all the things that are necessary, and I have. I said, but it will cut me off from developing. It will cut me off from being able to learn how to write a short story. I want to write fiction. And my parents said to me, well, look, we have a middle class, but if you live at home, we can support you. Learn to write, because you have no... I was married, obviously, as a kid. So I did. I took them up on it. And what I did was I learned how to write. I first learned how to write a sentence, and then I learned how to write a paragraph.
So they staked you.
They staked me. They really did.
First year, 2 years? Or
well, it was about two years. Then I got a job just out of the clear blue sky, complicated, writing a film in Israel. A man raised some money on a story which I had written.
Was it after this two-year period?
This was after the two-year period,
that you
right.
decided that
right.
you would...
Right, and by then I was beating...
Did you go to Israel for the purpose
yeah,
of writing
I,
the script?
Oh, yes. I went there for the purpose of writing the script, and then I acted in the film, and then I also began writing short stories. Because there, for the first time, I was face-to-face with the elementals of life and death. I mean, I was in an environment which admitted of no... little elegance, and it was about living or dying. I mean, it was very simple. It was a besieged society. It was at that time in the heroic period of its existence, its pioneering period, which finds ultimate expression in this book. I mean, particularly a kibbutz. I was on one kibbutz on the northern frontier, about which I finally wrote a book, and which remains very close to me to this day, a kibbutz called Mayan Baruch in the Galilee. But I did create my first mature short story. It was a story called The Blessing, which I sent to a woman, a wonderful woman in New York, I was spoiled for all time, who was not yet my agent, but was working for William Morris, a woman by the name of Liesl Eisenheimer. She's now an editor at McCall's, but immensely gifted, Liesl Kramer. And she said, you know, Hugh, this story will sell. You've done it. Hang on in there. And she was right. A wonderful woman by the name of Catherine Gauss Jackson, who remains one of the great loves of my life, one of my eldest daughters really named after her, is now gone. She was the daughter of Dean Gauss at Princeton. And through her, I felt a deep connection with Fitzgerald and Edmund Wilson. And she spotted me. I was 24, 25, I can't remember. And she said, okay. I mean, and she published me. Well, I mean, I don't have to tell you what that meant. Because it meant that even though I wasn't making any money, I was on my way. Because having published once, and it was a good story, it was really a grown-up story, it was a beautiful story, if I may say so myself, then I began writing short stories and perfecting my craft as a short story writer. And I had the immense good fortune, after writing three, I think, stories and publishing them in national magazines, I was lucky about that. I mean, I began publishing immediately in the big magazines, so it received attention. And then a wonderful man, an editor by the name of Donald Hutter, Don Hutter, remains a dear friend, was working then at Scribner's. And Don said, when you have seven stories, come in, because I'll publish you, because Scribner's was putting out short stories by young American writers. Well, I mean, that was really it. And I published my first volume of short stories to wonderful reviews. I, again, didn't make any money. But I was on my way as an artist, because I had really begun to master the form of the short story and to understand what I wanted to do as an artist with that form. And I kept thinking about the novel all the time, always. The second book I did was a study, it was a memoir, of this kibbutz in Israel. It was the first full-length. It was also a journal, which is very interesting. The second story, the third story that I wrote in my life, which was also published in Harper's, was a story called The Well, which still stands up quite beautifully, if I may say so myself, was also a journal. I was interested in the journal because from the very beginning, the work that obsessed me as an artist when I was a kid was T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland. And the juxtaposition of prose and poetry in that poem, in that magnificent revolutionary poem, where I read as a kid and I couldn't tell which was the prose and which was the poetry, and then I realized, my God, something really... It's a light went off in my head. I changed. I really changed. It was a religious experience. Also because of his utilization of myth. I mean, I was already conversant with the Fisher King and all of these things at 15. But then I found that an artist like T.S. Eliot, and I said it must have been okay. I was on the right track. But Eliot's specific utilization of the vernacular, the low vernacular, the spoken word, and the high, the great tradition, and also the idea of juxtaposing images and allowing them to be connected in the reader's mind. Not on the page, but the reader's mind. This was revelatory to me, and I filed it away. I mean, I knew that this was the path that I had to follow if I was going to. I always wanted to be an original artist. I mean, it seems to me if you're going to be a writer, you must strive for an original means of expression. And first you must master your craft, which is to say you must become a classical, you must master the classical forms, and which I spent many years doing. And then I was able, in this book particularly, to go ahead and to make my move into something new, a new voice, and a new means, based on the great tradition, which was, in my case, the American great literary tradition. Also, Ernest Hemingway, because obviously had an immense effect on me. The purity of his language, the lucidity of his language, was, for my generation, again, revelatory. I mean, not only Americans, but Europeans. I mean, I don't have to tell you.
The Tree of Life, while it takes the form of journal, and two of your books have taken that form already, it's still a major departure in terms of time and place. Did you have a major interest in this time and place? That didn't phrase it very well. What sparked your interest in this particular period?
Johnny Chapman, Johnny Appleseed. Years ago, I was at a cocktail party at a dear friend's, a woman by the name of Ann Chambers at that time, Ann Crudgenow, this is 20 years ago, and somebody asked me at this cocktail party, what are you thinking about? And I was between books or stories, I can't remember. And I said, I want to write a novel about John Chapman, Johnny Appleseed. And they said, why? And I said, because I discovered that he was a Swedenborgian mystic. And the religious sensibility has always fascinated me. I mean, I've always been, for complicated psychological reasons, deeply, passionately interested in human religious apprehension. All religions, to me, all mythological systems, I mean, they reflect so much of what we are and our deepest needs. And when I discovered that Johnny was indeed a Swedenborgian, I became obsessed with the figure, which I put away, and I continued to write and publish my books. And then, finishing up my last book, the one before this, My Own Ground, which took place, as I said, on the Lower East Side, and was an urban New York novel. And I wanted desperately to do a rural American novel. One gets bored. I mean, you know, I'd spent, 2 years and 9 months living in the New York and Lower East Side in 1911, and I wanted to write a novel that took place in the open air, and that had to do with the country experience, the rural experience, nature. I love writing nature. I love the natural world. And then I realized, almost immediately upon finishing the other book, that this I was committed to. And I took a deep breath, and I started research. Commencing around, it took 7 years, the whole thing.
Yeah, you had a dual amount of research to do, because not only did you have to know the historical events of that period, but you had to know language, the food, the instruments they used for everyday life. So you had a lot. Why did you do most of this?
I began researching. I went to Ohio. And I went to Mansfield because I had read a biography. There's one biography of John Chapman written by a professor. By the name, last name is Rice. I should get this straight because I owe him a debt. It's been so long now I can't remember. And there was an incident that took place in Mansfield, Ohio. And as soon as I read that, I said, that's for me. I knew that was the drama about which I had to write. And I went out to Mansfield. I signed a contract with Farrar, Straus & Giroux. My editor was there then, and I subsequently followed him when he left for Harper & Row. And I began immersing myself in you name it, I had to become, because if I didn't see it and I couldn't master it, you certainly would not respond to it. I became very interested in the weapons because my experience on the kibbutz taught me that on the frontier experience, every man has a piece, which is to say a weapon, which is to say a gun. Every man, you know, either you carry an AK-47 or you carry an M-16 or you carry an Uzi, because your weapon on the frontier is, after all, your life. And you are a farmer, and you're also a man who must handle a gun. And I began realizing that was a wonderful way to get in to the life on the frontier. And so I went up to Abercrombie & Fitch, and I told the gunsmith, whose name I can't remember, this goes back now, when Abercrombie was still around, and I said to him, look, this is my problem. And I described the character. All I knew about the man was that he was an educated New Englander. I had no inclination, no idea then that he was an artist, but he was a man. And he said, well, I have a gun for you. He said, there are replicas that you can fire. And I had read about these guns, but I didn't, what do they smell like? I mean, you know, when you shot one, nobody ever, and I had to find out, did they have a kick? I mean, how did you load them, really? And he brought out this gun, which is a Harper's Ferry a Model 1803, which figures in the book. And I held the gun, and I bought it, and I joined a black powder club in Neshannock, New Jersey, a man by the name of Charlie Stone, a wonderful man, a gunsmith, and a man who's a great authority on American history, and this period in particular. And Charlie taught me everything I know about flintlocks and muzzle loading, and I learned how to throw a tomahawk. And I went on a hunt in Pennsylvania. I just immersed myself. Then the most fortunate thing happened. I met, through the Ohio Historical Society, a man who is a curator of that society by the name of Don Hutzler, to whom the book, along with my family, is dedicated. And Don is a brilliant and gifted American historian, a man my age exactly, with my passionate interest in history and in everything. And we hit it off instantaneously. And so I was, therefore, on the phone. I would say Don and I spoke on the average of, twice a week for I don't know how long it was. And he was guiding me in the research and enabling me to, if I had, you name it, a question on, I'm making it up, the manufacture of booze, corn liquor, or certain problems of agriculture. Don was there and guiding me and helping me.
As you wrote the story of Thomas Keene, did you know as you began to put your first words on paper that you were making this into a journal, or did this evolve?
I knew immediately, because what I wanted was a form that would enable me to juxtapose images and fragments as in a poem. I wanted to write a poem, I must say. And I was immensely gratified to see that Christopher Lemonhap, the New York Times, pointed out that what I had done indeed was to write a poem. And that was my intention. I've been immensely fortunate in the critical reception. People are very smart, for the most part. There was a wonderful review in the Washington Post by a man by the name of Tom LeClaire, who teaches American literature out in Cincinnati, who pointed out that, of course, this derives from the wasteland. I mean, he saw quite clearly, and he's quite right. It seems to me, my ideology as an artist, is that the novel to survive must move toward poetry, because you can't compete as a novelist with what a movie or television can do. I mean, I can walk into a movie and instantaneously I can be transported go to a Kubrick film and you are in outer space, under the sea. I mean, I cannot compete as the 19th century novelist did with creating Marston Moore or, whatever. But I can do something that these other techniques cannot do, and that is reaffirm the supremacy of the word, which is the way of poetry.
There's something else that you did which is highly unusual. The Tree of Life includes a lot of maps, charts, drawings, and paintings, reportedly by Thomas Keene, the hero of your novel, but in actuality they're by Hugh Nissenson.
Yes, the maps are not. There are three, I guess, maps and sketches in there which Don Hutzler did, mm-hmm. But the other illustrations are a function indeed of Thomas Keene's vision. That's Don's. And that I just simply, he does it so beautifully, and he laid out a beautiful page. He's a wonderful draftsman. But they are not a function of Tom's vision. The other illustrations, of course, are, beginning with the first tombstone and ending with the picture of Johnny on the last tombstone. The Tree of Life is encompassed, of course, by two tombstones. I mean, after all, life is indeed encompassed by death. And the vision of our mother death, for example, which was a very important...
It's nice that you were able to, you've gone full circle. You have combined your childhood,
yep.
Both of your
yep.
childhood loves.
That's right. And I must say this, too, that I've discovered in my life that an artist must constantly return to childhood, very early childhood, for inspiration. It's where you live. In keeping that alive, I played as a kid in Central Park, Pioneers and Indians, because I read Walter Edmonds. Or I saw movies, Drums Along the Mohawk and Northwest Passage when I was a kid. And I would creep in Central Park with a stick, hunting. I was Rogers, of Rogers Rangers. And when I came to write this book, I was drawing quite self-consciously on my excitement as a kid when I fantasied these things. Someone told me, a friend of ours wrote me a letter saying that I revived in him memories which he had forgotten about Indian tortures, which all of us remember reading about when we were kids. I mean, I remember specifically being horrified by, I think it was a Jesuit missionary who was captured by the Mohawks in New York or in Canada, and they tied him up and they bit the tips of his fingers off, Well, it's things like, I mean, that make an immense impression on a child's mind. And I had to relive on a higher level, of course, in order to create this book. I want very much my next book to go into my childhood again, a little older, from the ages of about 10 to 12 or 13, when I discovered science fiction. I have all my life adored science fiction. I love pulp science fiction.
And I love still?
Yeah, I love the memory of it. I can't read it now.
That's the problem when you... See, this happened to me. I was in the 1950s when I was a teenager, and before I went into college, I love science fiction. I still have in a couple of boxes all my science fiction collection, and a couple of years ago I got it out, and I thought, well, I'm going to read Astounding Science Fiction from the first issue I had, which was 1946, to the last, a whole run of them, Galaxy and all the rest, and I started to read them, and I found that I just I have somehow, I have matured. The enthusiasm is still there, and I would never part with these books.
But the prose is so awful.
And in fact, one of the reasons that I changed my interest from science fiction to more adult literature was the result of a science fiction writer named Ray Bradbury, and because he transcended science fiction.
Sure, it happens. I venture to say, if you picked up now the early science fiction novels of H.G. Wells, I'm talking about the Time Machine, The War of the Worlds, and The Food of the Gods, and The Days of the Comet, and you picked up Jack London, and you read The Scarlet Plague again, and you read the wonderful fantasy sort of science fiction, The Star Rover, one of the best titles ever, or Before Adam, you would be as thrilled now. That's great prose. So it has been utilized by great artists as a medium of human expression. And I would like...
So are you going to do it?
Well, I'm going to take a shot at it. Also, I'm interested in the fact that the effect that these pulp magazines had, because they used illustration and text. And that was also sexy when I was a kid. The only kind of pictures of girls you could get were on the covers of these magazines.
Right.
And that plays an important role. I mean, sex is one of the things that, after all, is exciting about life. And you must... Isaac Bashevis Singer once said... to me, it has been my great privilege to know him somewhat over the last 10 years or so. And one said to me that a writer must write about love and sex. I mean, because it is, after all, a fundamental aspect of the human condition. And I agree. Also, I happen to believe too that you must, as a writer, write about war. I don't think he does, but I think that this is something that you must, because it is, unfortunately, an aspect of the human condition.
Or conflict, which can be used as a metaphor.
Right. Naturally, it is.
C.S. Snow wrote this wonderful book, which is set on a university campus in England called The Masters.
You know? Yes, of course.
Have you ever read that?
Sure.
If you want to read a war story, here is the most genteel group of men in existence who are savagely fighting with one another. And certainly that's can be considered a war story.
It is what one of the things that human life is about.
Whether it's a chess game or
but conflict. Without conflict, there is no art. I went up to Fieldston, where my eldest daughter goes to school, and I sat in an English class. Was it yesterday, the day before? And they were discussing Oedipus Rex, and they're 15-year-olds. And I was aware that here it is. I mean, a story of incest, murder. I mean, but this is the stuff out of which great art and great feelings come. And as an artist, what I'm interested in is making... Conrad said, you must make people see, and I believe that. But you must make them see in order to make them feel. And if you can't make them feel, and it can't evoke in them emotion about being human, then you're wasting your time.
Well, you have evoked emotion in The Tree of Life, and you've done this in the most spare, simple, and indeed poetic style imaginable, and it is, in my opinion... a true work of art.
Thank you for that.
I only had to read a few pages before I said I must talk to Hugh Nissenson. And of course, about two-thirds of the way into the book, where the Indian Wars really began, the book becomes impossible to put down. And the other night when I was finishing the book, I didn't go to the dinner table.
That's the greatest compliment I can
Did not
really
stop.
There was
a momentum.
Yeah.
That I could not stop.
That, of course, is the greatest compliment that I can receive, and it was deliberate. I mean, I believe that you cannot not only not sacrifice the narrative drive in fiction, but if you do so, you're doomed, because the story, One of my favorite movies is that Hamilton woman with Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh. And the last lines of that, so I don't know who wrote it. Last lines of the most wonderful last lines, I think, of any movie I know, in which Lady Hamilton is a prostitute in Calais, and she's told this story. And another prostitute says to her, "Well, Doc, you know, what happens then, what happens after?" And she says, the camera tight on her face, "There is no then, there is no after." But one of the things that as human beings you want to know is, what happens then, what happens after? And if you lose that, if you lose storytelling, you lose, it seems to me, what makes art work. I am not interested in anything that sacrifices to some false god the idea of narrative and a narrative power. The only thing that interests me is, you've got to tell, as you say, you paid me an immense compliment, you couldn't put the book down. Well, if I can't make people do that, I'm in the wrong game. I really am. And I believe in narrative drive.
Well, it's never too late to discover a writer, especially a good one. This has been my introduction to your work, and this is not going to be the last book I'm going to read by you. I'm
going
to seek out everything else to read because I'm so enthusiastic about it, and that's exactly what I'm going to say on my little news report, how enthusiastic I am about it. It's been a treat and a delight meeting you. And also, there's another thing. You're so enthusiastic. You are so overwhelmingly excited and enthusiastic about not only what you've done, but about the things around you and the word and the language. And so it's exciting being able to talk to someone.
It's exciting for me to talk about it and to have you, to have to find, the thing that frightened me about this book, I must be honest, is I knew really what I had done, but you don't know how it's going to be received. There's no way to judge, and it was terrifying. I have been immensely fortunate with this book. But,
and the unfortunate thing is that it doesn't matter what you've done in terms of the quality or the amount of work that you've spent on it, and because people judge it in a way that may not even be accurate. And that's what's frightening. People can make snap judgments. A beautiful case in point is John Gardner's front page review of Sophie's Choice, which was on the New York Times Sunday Book Review several years ago. And John Gardner, late John Gardner, lacerated Sophie's Choice.
Excuse me, I think that was, if I may say so, Bill Sheed.
Was what?
I think it was...
Was it
Gardner?
It was Gardner.
Apologize to Sheed. I thought it was.
I'll tell you why.
All right,
tell you why it was Gardner. I happen to admire Sophie's Choice very much. And I had Styron in.
You're right. It was, of course.
I had Styron in, and not too long. He comes in about every year, and we just chat. Even if he doesn't have a book out, he comes in just to chat, and bring me up to date on what he's been doing. So he mentioned that I would probably be interested in a new book of critical essays being published by an outfit called Hall in Boston, in a limited edition, rather expensive book, but he knew that I liked his work. And he said that it was interesting because there are some critical analysis of Sophie's Choice, including one by John Gardner. And he said he phoned John Gardner to see if he could have permission to include this book. And Gardner said, yes, you can, on one condition, that you let me include a postscript repudiating everything I said about it, because I do think that Sophie's Choice is a masterpiece.
Wow.
And Styron said, I wish you had said that.
A little late, yes.
In the front page review.
A little late.
Well, Gardner said I was wrong. I have reread the book subsequently, and I have reassessed it, and I was wrong. I was just wrong.
It's a nightmare. It has happened to me a great deal in the Sunday Times, I have to say. I have been fortunate there, and I've also, with this book, I was immensely unfortunate. And it happens. You fool. What are you going to do? Lots of luck. I mean, the book has survived it, not only survived it, but triumphed over it. But it is... It's a little late. You have to be very fortunate.
But there is one good thing. One is an established writer. It doesn't help a writer who is not too established. But someone like Irving, for example, he says he doesn't care what the reviewers say about his work now, because he has an audience for it who will buy his work, and it doesn't matter to them. And this is particularly true of the people who sell the mass market things Arthur Haley and people like that, Harold Robbins, they have the built-in reader. Even Michener. Michener has not had a good review in years, doesn't make any difference.
It makes no difference. He rockets right to
Texas had a first publication of 150,000.
Unbelievable.
So it doesn't matter, and I have yet to see a good review of it.
No, it's true. It's It's a very strange life being a serious writer. No one holds a gun to your head, but sometimes you feel like taking a gun and sticking it to your head yourself because you are at cross purposes, it seems. And when you are fortunate, this book has been nominated for the American Book Award. Well, that's a tremendous break. What will happen one way or the other, I don't know. But it is, I feel myself immensely lucky. I got to tell you, all my life, well, certainly the last decade of my life, I have been terrified by the fate of Herman Melville. I really mean it. There's a wonderful biography of Melville Miller wrote, and it is a terrifying life. A man who is a titan, who, by virtue of his originality and his lack of sentimentality in the 19th century, and what he was trying to do, was absolutely misunderstood as soon as he departed from conventional, you know, stuff. I mean, when he produced his great masterpiece, he was absolutely ignored. And as we know, it was not until his death, way after his death, that he was rediscovered by Columbia. I mean, well, this is a terrifying experience.
Who in that day wanted to read a book about fishing?
Well, let me tell you, it's terrifying because you realize it's a question of luck. Now, you cannot tell me, for example, that the latter work, the great work of Mark Twain, is any lighter in its tonality than Moby Dick. I mean, what is darker than the Letters from the Earth or The Last, I mean, The Mysterious Stranger? Terrifying, dark vision. And yet, was he misunderstood, Twain, in the right way? I mean, did they take him for a sentimentalist? He also played a role, you see. He was very fortunate insofar as Mark Twain, as an American artist, was able to dress in a white suit and become you have to have luck. Because if you are serious and if you are trying to be, if you are original and you are serious, God help you.